Recording in progress.
Hi.
Hey.
Hello.
So does that mean we're back on Zoom now because it says that really loud, or are we just giving up on all technology and just
JJ,
sitting in the same room?
Are you on mute? We can't hear you.
Oh, okay. Shit.
He's just trolling you. We heard you just fine.
Yeah, I doubt that's actually on the recording though.
I don't actually know when it yeah, that's a good question. When does it actually start recording?
Yeah, is it like after it doesn't put the recording message in the recording, surely.
Yeah. Well, no, it doesn't. It doesn't read that out.
Okay.
No, that's just piped to into your earbuds.
I wonder if this is like a half-life problem. Like every step closer to recording is always half the distance to recording starting. So yes. We never quite get there.
All right. So here's what we'll do. Next week, JJ, when she says recording started, make one of your hand fart noises and we'll see if the hand fart noise gets through, even though she's talking.
Sounds good.
All right.
That's rather than, you know, picking something like say hi or make a snapping sound, we decide to do hand farts.
But it's JJ's thing.
It's true.
Okay.
I've known you for years without knowing that was your thing.
I thought
so many other things could have been your thing, but I'm glad you chose that.
I do it when I'm in real deep thought, actually. I just sit there and I do. It's like how I used to do it.
And someone married you?
What's weird is I've actually seen him do a hand shot.
Oh, okay.
So for those of you listening, welcome to the children's channel. You know, we're all children here.
The hallway chat. So just gonna say, how's everybody doing?
I'm doing great. I'm here. It's Thursday? It's nearly the end of the week. I've survived another week. I'll probably survive through to another week. That's pretty good. I'm
like
breathing.
I'd say that right now is the first cold front of fall has really hit Texas, which makes me very happy, but also very covered in allergies. So it's been a lovely week.
Wait, what does cold mean for Texans? Like,
dude, like 85?
Yeah, it got down to that mid-80s. I had to go find my sweater.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
You sure you don't want to move down here?
Yeah. No, I mean, I would have if it wasn't in Texas, and if Texas weather during the summer wouldn't melt my loved one.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. No, it's fair. It's approaching. We're in that magical period where every Minnesotan says it's not fall, but it's actually fall for the 3 weeks that fall exists until winter gets here. Mm-hmm. And I know because it started to get below 60 in the morning and now it's like sustaining below 60 for part of the day. And within, I give it two and a half weeks to for snowfall or some shit like that.
So below 60, do you have to wear some sort of special skin protection so that you protect your skin from like falling off at that?
Yeah, Minnesotans call it shorts and a tank top. Yeah, that's the appropriate thing to wear if you're local. I've been pulling out sweatshirts, but I stand out.
Very nice.
I was going to say in Texas, our fall is literally a day. Maybe two, and then it turns into winter.
Just like a single hailstorm, and then you just move on.
Pretty much.
Well, it's like faux fall, right? Because we get like a week or two of cold, and then it gets hot again, and then end of October it starts to get cold again, or we have a surprise snowstorm, which we had at KubeCon, right? And that was that
right?
October or November?
That was October.
It was November.
Oh, no, November. Yeah,
early November. Oh, yeah,
that's when I got recruited to join IBM. That KubeCon, actually.
Aw, memories.
But my favorite recent October Halloween was when it was cold enough to in Texas to put a fire pit on the front of my street so I could have a little fire pit where I was giving out candy. Well, before COVID, obviously. Was I was able to give out candy and be around a fire pit. That was so great.
At the front of your street?
Oh, sorry. No, front of my driveway. From my driveway.
Okay, so now we know your driveway is a street. That's good to know. It's long enough.
Also, speaking of you, JJ, I heard you. I mean, how's that stand mixer going? Are you slapping wet?
Yeah.
That's coming out wrong already. are you not beating the hell out of your. What am I trying to do here?
Yeah, well, it's a follow from follow-up from last week, right? Where I traditionally would use my bread hook on my strand mixer for like super high for like 10 minutes, right?
And would it make this noise? Oh, I can't quite get it.
Yeah, it actually fell off of my counter once and like broke some of my tile and my inside my
yeah. And you still kept using it that way. I'm so impressed with you.
You had it on so high it was walking off the edge. Okay. You had it on so high like it tried to kill itself. It literally committed suicide.
Yeah. Yeah,
they're heavy and they have some pretty good like rubber feet. How did it walk off your counter?
It could have smushed your new puppy. Just to be clear about the weight proportion.
Not this one. It was my previous one, but no joke. I kicked it off and normally it's fine. And then it was almost like out of a cartoon. I was like, okay, it's going great. I'm gonna go bio real quick. I come back into the kitchen, and I just see it like just coming off the edge, and I'm like, no. And then it just went thud, and there's a hole in the center of my kitchen's tile in my kitchen where there's like this just hole there that we just basically trip on. It's just right there to perfectly like get your toe stuck into or whatever. It's really annoying. So
I mean, like, yeah. I imagine your wife was very, very furious about this.
Oh yes, yes. And I keep meaning to fix it, but I'm just not very handy.
And, oh, dude, I can talk you through some tile work. I've messed around with that now.
Yeah, so.
But all of that happened, and it wasn't enough to tell you that maybe you had it on too fast?
No, I just held it. I held it down after that. I just held it.
It was like a shake weight workout for him.
I would just drape one of the children over it. It was fine.
It's fine. You can lose one of them. So do you feel like you learned to use it correctly, or is that still TBD?
No. So with my new stand mixer that I got, so after the conversation, I really did take it to heart. I'm like, all right, you know what? Fuck it. I'm actually going to just put it on number two and let it just roll that whole time. And what I did, and I have these pictures, I'm planning on putting this up on my blog, is I took pictures every 5 minutes during that time to actually see the difference in the dough coming together. And after 45, yes, it was 45 minutes, but after 45 minutes, it was exactly the state I needed it to be. And I was able to cook the bread just fine and everything came out great. So
I still think you're like way over kneading that dough.
Really?
Yeah.
Like you should not have to, like, 10 to 15 minutes.
I can't shape it unless it doesn't but again, like
I think it's still too wet then. Is it just because it takes that long to all come off the sides?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's too wet. So I mean, if you enjoy the results, that's great. Yeah. Don't let me tell you you're doing it wrong if you enjoy the results.
He's just gonna tell you you're doing it wrong every week.
At the same time, I do feel like maybe you could adjust your recipe to better suit the stand mixer. Or if you really want the wet dough, think about how you would do like stretch and fold, right? Because if you look at the artisanal bakeries that do really wet doughs, they're all about like stretch and fold type stuff versus like the big old industrial Hobart stand mixers. Although the big old industrial Hobart stand mixers can take beating the shit out of the dough. So, you know.
Yeah.
And it doesn't fall off your countertop.
I mean,
right.
To me, this sounds like your very, very standard dev thing, right? We're lazy. We try to get something done fast. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it works at 2. It'll work at 11. It's fine. It just is faster. I'm in a hurry. 11.
Thank you, Laura. Exactly.
No, I'm not saying this is a good idea. Wait a second here.
If you're not supposed to crank it to 11, why is there an 11 on the dial?
Exactly.
Because you use the 11 for other things. That's why there's multiple attachments.
If you have 32 gigabytes of memory on your laptop, why not run Slack with taking up 31
okay,
of them?
Hold on. That is the development mindset of Chrome developers and Slack developers.
That's
not what I'm saying. Think this is a great thing.
Well, that was lovely.
Yeah.
You know, shifting into the tech mindset, I think DevOps days was a thing. I saw some friendly faces on Twitter talking about days of DevOps and
days of DevOps, DevOps days.
I like to switch it up. So DevOps days, Houston. Laura, didn't you attend?
I wasn't at Houston. I did Portland and Istanbul, and I'm going to be at Boston.
Oh man, you're like,
wait, hang on. Istanbul was virtual, right?
Yeah.
Istanbul was virtual. Thankfully. Okay. Yeah. No, I got up for, I think 3 AM my time to make it to my talk on a Saturday to do Istanbul. They were actually really nice. I loved it.
Oh, I'm sure Istanbul sounds amazing, but 3 AM can piss right off.
Constantinople.
It was We're all dancing right now in this visual medium podcasting, but all of mine were virtual. But I hear JJ was at Houston, which was in person.
Are we back doing in person?
How that went?
Yes. So DevOps Days Houston was one of the first, if not the first, to be really. DevOps Days Minneapolis was.
Minneapolis was first.
Was first.
That's for DevOps Days.
And DevOps Days Houston took that as a sign, and I was I am an organizer there, so I got to help organize to build this up. And we haven't actually had a ritual yet, so a lot of these are just my thoughts. But the short of it is, as much as I want this to be a thing, people are still really gun-shy about coming out. And there was a direct relationship between that gun-shyness and the attendance. The first day, it was okay. Like, we did some really great things about making sure everybody felt safe. We had 6-foot rounds where no more than 2 people could fit at a table or should be at a table. And we had space for 200 people. So we had a really, really nice space to do this. But by the second day, it was slim pickings. And I love the organizer team. They really did put their heart into it and all and everything. But I'm just, my gut's telling me that until people get more comfortable with being in the world, I'm worried that DevOps Days face to face just isn't going to be a thing.
Now, was it a hybrid conference? Was it both?
No,
it was in person only.
In person only. Okay.
I thought that was supposed to be a hybrid move. Yeah. Wow. So I guess what's interesting there is, I was going to say, if it was a hybrid conference, I wonder how it adversely affected the remote people being so focused on, you know, being in person first. I'm thinking about this because KubeCon coming up will be hybrid. But if they totally took away the remote experience completely, I don't know if that's better or worse than trying to do a hybrid, to be honest.
Have any of you been on like hybrid teams? Like some remote, some in person?
It's the worst. When you're the only one, it's so horrible.
I've run hybrid conferences back at Rackspace. We actually, every year we had a hybrid conference because we weren't allowed to fly everybody in from all around the world. So we ran an internal conference that was called Rack.io, and it was
hybrid. You rejected me a few times.
You weren't working there. We couldn't have random people there. It was all internal. Sorry. anyway, I also didn't know you then. So
yeah, that's true.
Sorry.
That's true.
But
on paper call. I was going to.
I know it was on paper. Anyway, we'll argue this later. But I'd say the big thing that someone needs to remember if they're going to be doing a hybrid conference is you need to play to the camera, not to the rest of your audience. And you have to have an MC that can be live on Slack responding to people. We were using Slack, but like whatever text-based system you're using to have remote people interacting, you have to respond to people really fast as part of being an MC in a hybrid conference so that they feel like they are sitting there with everyone else. And then you have to nominate one person for each track to be the remote question person and literally go up, stand in line at the mic with everyone else and ask the questions for the remote person. When we did it that way, everybody felt like they were involved. When we tried to do it the other way, where you just kind of are on video and you're watching the live stream and you're not really participating, people stopped coming. So I think that's the only way it's going to work. And I am afraid that KubeCon probably won't do that. And that's hard.
I think I have a lot of faith in the organizers of KubeCon to like put a lot of effort into that, at least around the main tracks. Like they, I'm privy to some of the community planning going on for the community activities. And honestly, the people that put their energy into that is just fantastically hardworking and caring about people's experiences. But I think it's just fair to acknowledge that trying to have in-person intimacy and remote connection at the same time is really quite difficult. And it kind of comes down to technology, like the one input for audio or the one single lens that people are seeing through. It just kind of sucks. It's a non-optimal, and it's a question of like, can we live with non-optimal in order to be inclusive of everybody? And sometimes it's going to be yes in my book, and sometimes it's going to be no.
I was, so I don't know, I'm not going to name the company, but being that I'm part of the organizers committee, I get the organizers' emails, and there was an event manager that sent a very angry email, angry email this morning when their team came back and reported back the possible weeds for the sponsorship and what they were doing. Now, I tried to empathize with it, being like, oh yeah, I mean, it was a first time kind of thing, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But then at the same time, this company, I didn't actually recognize their name. I had to look at who they were. And they only spent like not a lot of money in the grand scheme of things, like from what at least I see gets spent at other conferences. And how angry that person was and how disappointed they were in the sponsorship. I felt almost abusive.
I'm missing, maybe I'm missing what you're saying. So they were a sponsor. Yes. And they paid for sponsorship.
Yes.
And are they just mad because they didn't automatically get everyone's name as a lead? Or are they mad because they failed at collecting leads? Like where is the, like people didn't show up and therefore there was no leads? Like what are they questions. Actually mad about?
Very good question. So the first one was, yes, they did ask for the leads originally or the list, but DevOps Days policies doesn't allow that. So I said, no, sorry, we can't do that. They're like, okay, cool. So what can we do? Well, you can have like a booth where you can have a booth with people and, you know, give away something or get people to opt in. And I'm assuming with the low attendance and the, frankly speaking, when I start thinking about it, the unenthusiastic booth people, because they were just sitting there on their laptops, like no one knew what the company was. They weren't engaging. Right. You know, as an organizer, you walk around to make sure everyone's okay. Like for her to turn around and send that email in a very aggressive, negative way, I felt bad. Like, I was like, I'm sorry. Like, I didn't respond, right? Obviously, because that's not my, like, it should come from the organizer team. But when you read that, like, I feel empathetic with, like, they spent the money, they were expecting some ROI. But at the same time, she, for how much negativity in it, like, it felt like she was, she doesn't realize, it's almost like she didn't realize there's a bunch of volunteers trying to do something for the community, right? Like she was assuming it was like going to some random corporate conference or something.
Yeah, and I feel like that's pretty common with DevOps Days and companies that haven't ever sponsored a DevOps Days before. Mm. And usually DevOps Days conferences are pretty good at setting expectations with their sponsor prospectus and everything. But occasionally that just doesn't quite get through to the right people and they don't quite get it. And it kind of sucks because it sours a potentially good relationship, but also like, don't sweat it. It's not a big deal.
It's just shitty to wake up to them the next morning, right?
Yeah.
Like, first email I read is, this is, we're a fuck up. No, that ain't cool.
No, I mean, the really important thing to take away, like empathy toward a startup spending money on a conference is very thoughtful. Any sum of money that you're sponsoring when you're early is a lot of money.
Oh, no, this is a corporation. This has been around for about 20 years. So they're not like a startup with like no money. They're actually a relatively large.
Well, then just wash away that little bit of empathy I held, because then the main point is like, don't talk to people like that. Yeah. If you think that's a professional way to talk to somebody, you're immediately wrong. Whatever point you're trying to make is no longer valid. And you can rest assured, JJ, that you're fine. You did nothing wrong. Yeah. This person sucks. And, or they were just sucking in that moment. Maybe they're a great person out of it, but screw that. It's not on you. Do not sweat this.
I'd say what, so there's two things that it sounds like to me. One, it's somebody who maybe this is their first time doing event management. They don't know what to expect. Mm. Or two, to be honest, they've been hurting a ton more even than DAs when it comes to, like, even more than DevRel when it comes to this whole remote conference thing, because it's really hard to sponsor and get leads and things. And their OKRs are pretty much screwed. Yeah. So I'd say like those two things are going on, especially considering you're at the end of the month.
Oh, and you're at
the end of the quarter.
Quarter. Yeah.
So if your bonus is tied somehow to generating leads and it's a monthly bonus, that probably is part of that frustration. Should they take it out on you? Absolutely not. It's completely inappropriate. However, I can empathize with where that person might be in their head, especially knowing the event people that I do and how much this has hurt, especially if they don't have a lot of room to get creative with events. I mean, webinars aren't doing well right now. Lots of things like that, just because people are burnt out on Zoom calls, and who wants to watch a pre-recording if it's not even live and you can't ask a question. So,
hey, speaking of burning out, I think we've got some barbecue related things to talk about. So I know there's a couple of things going on. We've got, I wanted to circle back on JJ's ribs.
You're a circle back kind of guy.
I believe Matt also followed through with his promise and smoked a brisket.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. So what do we want to, do we want to start by shitting on JJ or save that for after we talk about the brisket?
How about we talk about the brisket?
All right. Let's go with the brisket.
So you can shit on me first, because I had such an epic journey trying to tame this hunk of beef. I don't have a big enough, I have a charcoal grill effectively. It's a fancy charcoal grill, but a charcoal grill nevertheless. So the best I can do is indirect sort of smoking, put it on one side, make sure the airflow is coming through the other side and try to control the heat that way. And I bought a 5-pound point. So mace, not much of the flat. They kind of cut it in the middle. There was some flat underneath, a lot of point.
A5 Wagyu, of course.
Yeah, for my first one, obviously. Yeah. No, it was a really nice. I actually don't know the exact cut, but I know it's from like a local farm. Like they only source from Minnesota and Wisconsin. And it's not cheap and it's really good consistently. But anyway, so got this brisket. I totally over trimmed it, like cut off way too much fat of it.
Oh no.
Got it smoking. It's doing all right. I couldn't control the temperature. I'm like, I can get things to dial in at like 250 ish, but then it like bounces up to 275 sometimes. And I was really wanted it at 200 to 225. And it's the charcoal I like to use is out. So I don't want to make excuses. I'm more just trying to tell you like how weird of a journey it was. So I did about a 5-hour smoke before I realized this thing's not going to cook on time by the time I thought in my head, which was 7 hours. It was only at 150 then, and it was hitting that flatten out point. Paul talked me off a cliff, and I wrapped it and I put it in the oven, and it took another 4.5 hours to finish smoking.
Closer to
Oof. 11, really. Okay. I took it out of the oven at 10 p.m., let it rest, wrapped it around midnight, and put it in the fridge. It was very not what I planned.
That was definitely what happened when we did a turkey. I completely understand where you were, where it's just like, put the damn thing in the oven.
You're just like, go to your home, get to temperature, let me eat you. Like, it was so much more challenging. So I'll pause there. Paul?
All right, Paul. What happened?
I mean, the obvious thing is, like, anytime I'm cooking a brisket or something that I'm not super familiar with, I err on the side of like starting way earlier than I expect to. So like just doing a brisk point, I would probably start at sun up. I would also maybe cook it the previous day and do a super long, low heated rest. So when I do a whole brisket, I will actually put it in the, I will cook it through the day. And then when it's ready, I will put it in the oven at the oven's lowest setting, which I think is 165 or 170, and leave it in the oven overnight at that temperature. And that makes sure that any of the things that didn't fully break down in the smoking are totally broken down in the thing. And if you talk to any of the like barbecue restaurants, like the craft barbecue restaurants, that's effectively what they do, but with like food warmers rather than an oven. And there's so much fat and so much collagen and everything else in there that it's totally happy with that kind of lengthy heated rest. So that's what I do for full brisket. For a half brisket, especially the point, I would probably do the same, because that's the most forgiving part of it. So yeah, definitely start way earlier, especially on a new thing you're not familiar with. But otherwise, like, I don't think you did badly. Like you recovered it with wrapping it. You realized you were having heat issues. You switched to the oven after wrapping it, which is fine because you've already got the smoke in, right? Yeah. You're not going to get more smoke through a bunch of foil. So all of this is totally fine. You took it out, you rest it for a couple of hours, you put it in the fridge. Now, the important thing is, what did you do to eat it?
Microwave it high, right?
Perfect. No. What was your? I assume you had something else for dinner. You didn't have dinner at 5 a.m.
Yes. No, we ordered a pizza. And then this was actually, so Paul got it in my head. I don't think I would have thought of it, but he said, pull out the sous vide to warm it back up. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, that makes so much sense, because I couldn't really afford to lose any more moisture anyway. So popping that in a Ziploc, even though I don't have a vacuum seal, but I've got Ziploc'd it, dunked it, and sous vide it for probably
put it in a bag? I thought you just put the meat in the water.
Yeah, that's how you get the water to taste that like nice briskety, exactly. Refreshing. Soup. Right. It's like hot ham water, but exactly. With brisket.
Hot dog water,
hey. But brisket. Yes. So yeah, I sous vide it for, I think it was like a good 4 hours, at like 72. 165, and I took it out, and there's definitely like some moisture at the bottom of the bag. But when I took it out and sliced it, it was honestly freaking fantastic. I was very happily surprised.
All right. So here's my question, and this is like to everybody, I guess. For those of us who are allergic to having more kitchen devices,
ooh,
like me,
yeah, that's real.
I do not have sous vide. I will never have sous vide. I'm going to say this, and I'm sure we'll end up getting one for
Christmas. I'm going to order you one right after.
We're all going to pitch in and just buy you one.
I really don't want one because our kitchen is small enough as it is. Like, I've always been taught, you put it in the oven, you put some juices in there with it. You do it that way. Or, yes, seriously, in the microwave, but you put a gigantic cup of hot water in with it.
Yeah, I would not do microwave for something like a brisket, like some chicken thighs or something. Yeah. Sure, whatever.
I do that with pizza.
Oven would be fine. What I would say with the oven is like, do it at a low temperature, keep it wrapped in foil. Add, if you're worried about it drying out, add fat, not water, because spoiler alert, when you bite into meat and it's moist, that is fat, not water.
Okay.
So you think about like you're having
mind bone,
like a stew or something, like a beef and Guinness stew. Have you ever eaten the beef from a stew or a soup and it's been dry?
Very much so.
Obviously.
Totally.
Right?
Yeah.
What?
And that's...
Wait, y'all have really done that?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It tastes like almost chalky.
Yeah.
Because it's just actually all the water is running out of it.
How are you all making that then?
I don't.
I'm not making it. I'm eating other people's food that don't know how to cook.
Obviously,
it's not me. I'm not the problem. I've totally done it. And the reason is because like you bite into it, like the water just disappears. You're not feeling the water as like mouthfeel. What you're feeling as moist in the mouthfeel is actually fat. So if you want to make sure something doesn't dry, you're actually better off getting a bunch of fat in with it. So you'd just put a stick of butter in with it when you wrap it, slather it in olive oil or like tallow or something. And the other thing that will do is it'll almost create a bit of a barrier so that moisture won't come out, because like fat and water aren't friends. So there's a couple of things that happen there, but that's the real key is if you want something to have like a moist mouthfeel, you do that with fat, not with water.
Well, I just want to say you do sustain like water in meat, right? If you put, I mean, all the recipes for brisket and for pork butt have been like put a water pan underneath. And the story I tell myself is that like the steam of that water like will prevent some of the wicking of the moisture out, because you're keeping the surface wet. That way water doesn't kind of seep out.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know the specifics, but certainly you do want a bit of a humid environment for it to cook in. And if you're doing like a grill type environment, there's not a lot of moisture to be found. I think if you've got like a Kamado style cooker, like JJU with Big Green Egg, they tend to like trap the moisture from the brisket or whatever in a lot better. Even with your offset smoker, they tend to. But some of the like closer to being direct heat cookers, Weber's and your PK, certainly the water pan can help.
Yeah, I'm also questioning my story after that, because I bet the moisture could also be about like moisture is necessary for smoke to infuse into the meat, if I've got that correctly, or is that a myth?
I don't think moisture as much, but certainly smoke doesn't attach to fat very well. And so that's why trimming a brisket and stuff is actually a pretty good idea, because if you have a big, thick fat cap, you're going to end up losing a ton of the smoke flavor, because as small amounts of the fat start building up on the fat's also rendering off. And so you're constantly trying to replace that top layer of like smoky stuff.
Cool. Yeah. We'll have to explore that a bit more. I think the chemistry of that would be fascinating to poke at. I'm sure Harold McGee wrote about it. So anyway, so I cut a little bit too much of the fat cap off. I was told the sweet spot's like 1/4 inch.
Yeah, I think 1/4 inch is good to go for, but like it's also not that big a deal. Like a point especially should have enough intramuscular fat that the fat cap itself isn't that big a deal. And if you leave too much fat on, it can be unpleasant. So I would rather have less fat than too much fat. So I mean, it may have had a minor adverse effect, but I don't think it would have been like that much better if you had left an extra like 1/5 of an inch of fat on or anything.
Word. Well, cool. Well, thanks for the support as always, Paul. And yeah, gang, it was real, real tasty. So it ended up being fun, just a little stressful here and there along the way.
Is it going to be the picture for this podcast?
It absolutely can be. Yeah.
All right. Consider it done.
So with the microwaving brisket out of the way, JJ, tell me more about, did you end up watching that video that Paul forced down our throats on the 3-2-1 method being a big lie?
Yes. So I first, what I got out of it is that he decided to change the recipe of the 3-2-1 to something very specific. And I looked at it and I was watching it, and there's no way in hell I can get 180 degrees, 200 degrees and 180 degrees, I think was the video, for the 3-2-1 on my smoker. Like, I'm lucky I can keep it at like 250, right? So I'm thinking I didn't get the message correctly though.
Is that right? Yeah, so I think you probably weren't quite paying attention right at the start. And he didn't, I feel like he didn't do a great job right at the start of explaining what he was doing. But so just take a step back. There's a guy called Harry Su. He was super big in the early explosion of like competition barbecue, like televised competition barbecue. He was kind of one of the big names that was on a couple of the televised shows about the barbecue pit masters. And he did a thing that was basically trashing the 3-2-1 method, saying that basically you end up with overcooked ribs. And, you know, it was pretty similar, but a bit more detailed to, I think, what we talked about a few weeks ago when we were talking about ribs. But then he goes on to say, if you want to make ribs using 3-2-1, so 3 hours, then 2 hours wrapped, then 1 hour unwrapped, here is the precise temperatures to do it, to get it to turn out how you want good ribs to turn out. And so that's why he was like 180 degrees for 3 hours, wrap it at 200 and then 180 again for the last, or whatever those numbers were. Those numbers were basically him getting the best results out of sticking to 3-2-1 versus cooking it until it's done.
And so it's the TLDR though, or TLDW, I guess. Too long, didn't watch. Anyway, it was like he just said, just throw the ribs in for like 3 hours and call it a day, right? Or am I missing that too?
Yes and no. Yes, throw the ribs in for 3 hours and call it a day, but really, not 3 hours, but until they're ready.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. So it's not about time. It's about how they feel. And you can substitute the internal temperature for how they feel if you don't feel confident in your ability to feel it. Mm-hmm. But it is definitely different across different ribs from different pigs and stuff, the actual finished, like done temperature. So that's why feel is always super important. So I think a lot of people settle on smoke it until it's just about done or fully done. Then if you want to wrap it for a little while, because it's as got as much color and bark as you want, you don't want to overbark it, you wrap it. And then when it's ready, so when it's at that like 205-ish, 210-ish, whatever that specific number is, or when it feels right, you then kind of do a quick sauce if you want to have sauce, and just let that sauce kind of set and call it done. So the wrapping for the 3-2-1, that's kind of harking into some of the competition barbecue where they're adding like a stick of butter, they're adding a bunch of extra flavors like beef broth, and they're adding extra seasoning and stuff. That's all about like packing flavors in, because the person that's judging you is only going to have one small bite. And so for the home cook, you don't want to put all that extra shit in there because you want to eat the whole rack of ribs.
My cholesterol got so high last year because I didn't know that was for competitions. I thought that's just how you're supposed to serve ribs.
Nice.
Son of a gun. I'm with you, JJ. The only times I've done ribs, I don't think I've said it here, but I just want to be on team JJ here in this case, that I was doing 3-2-1. I was freaking throwing a block of butter and a bunch of brown sugar in as you wrap the ribs. Yep. And like, no doubt that shit is delicious, but is it possibly overdone? Is it way oversaturated with fat and flavor? Totally. Absolutely true.
When my family devours three racks of ribs with no questions asked, they're asking the question is, where's the fourth rack of ribs? Usually you've got a winner.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just like, do you want them to be able to do that in 30 years?
Yeah. Good point.
I guess that's a way to kind of end up the discussion is like, even if the 3-2-1 is not the optimal way to cook ribs, if it's what works for you and your family, that's cool. But I do highly recommend like experimenting with it and maybe seeing if you can get it to a better state. If you can't, then stick to 3-2-1.
Mm-hmm. Or, well, all this food talk has me hungry. Okay. Paul, you had some news from a burger place that we've grown to love and trust that maybe we shouldn't have.
This was an interesting thing that I actually didn't even know about until I stumbled across it, where, you know, somebody was joking about like the average person not being able to understand maths. And it was at some point quite some time ago, like years and years ago, A&W, who I'm not even super familiar with because I don't think they ever really got out of the US apart from maybe Singapore. But they decided they wanted to beat McDonald's, and they wanted to beat McDonald's's Quarter Pounder. So they did a big promotional marketing campaign to have a third pounder burger at the same price. And it did really poorly, and they couldn't figure out why. And they brought in people to do a study, and the end result was people thought that a third was smaller than a quarter, and therefore they were getting less value.
Oh, that hurts. So,
Laura,
so much.
Are you able to talk? Because you've done science and math stuff before. Like, how does that mistake happen?
Science and math, which is the bigger question there. Not just done stupid? Science and math stuff.
Are we all stupid, or is there like an obvious mistake there that is easy and like we should cut ourselves a break? Like, was it our fault, or was it marketing's fault?
I like that, so, marketing as a category. Okay.
I mean, I actually can kind of believe the legit part of this, that people go like, well, a quarter pounder is bigger than a third of a pound. Because I think it's actually partially that people have trouble with fractions in general. Like if this was like the 2-quarter pounder, they'd be like, oh, 2 is better than 1. But when it comes to, I think it's the pounder and pound actually, like a third of a pound versus a pounder, makes people kind of feel like they're maybe getting a little more. So I kind of wonder if it's actually semantics. But I have to admit, I am 100% reminded of that, the story of the kid with the change. Have you ever heard this story?
Yeah.
So it's like, the dad gives the kid a dollar. And then someone says, oh, well, I'll give you 2 quarters for that dollar. And they go, oh yeah, 2 is better than 1. And so they trade for the 2 quarters, and so on and so forth, until the kid has like 10 pennies and he takes it back to his dad. Like, look, I did this. And dad just kind of face palms. Like, that's like, you never really hear dad's reaction.
Yeah.
But you can imagine that face palm moment where the kid realized the kid thought, oh, 2 is better than 1.
Mm-hmm.
4 is better than 2. Onward and onward until.
And 4 is greater than 3. Therefore, I want a quarter pounder.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's really what's happening, is that number and that semantics.
Yeah. I think what they were saying was that when people were faced with the 2 fractions sort of side by side, they would see the 3 and the 4 versus it being 1 on 3 and 1 on 4.
Yeah.
And so I totally get it. And I don't know. They were using
another reason for the metric system.
It's just amen. A fucking man.
But then it would be, hang on, that would be a quarter of a kilo versus a third of a kilo. It's still the same problem.
Well, I guess maybe we should just say, like, they should have said like
200 grams versus 300 grams.
8 ounces, 4 ounces, right. However big it is.
Yeah.
0.33 is 0.25.
How many acres of burger?
There's a furlong in here. What the hell?
So what? It's 16 ounces to a pound. So yes. Take a third of that. A third of 16 is not actually a good number, but let's pretend that it's close. It's close to 5. So they probably should have set a 5-ounce burger, which would have been bigger than 1/4.
Yeah.
At the bottom. Yeah. So they should have set a 5-ounce, 5-ouncer instead of a third pounder.
Oh, now we got our marketing hats on. This is some serious, this is product management. This is fun.
But
then you're hearing ounce versus pound. So that might still skew.
Oh. It might. See, that's the thing, is that like, we are very easy to deceive as human beings. It's very easy for us to get deceived by. Yes, it is.
We're also egotistical morons.
But in general, I find, and I guess this is kind of veering off into the realm of education and like theory and kind of interesting stuff. I really find it interesting how much people hate mathematics. And I think all of it is in our heads. I really don't think people have as much problem with mathematics as they make it sound. Because when I start explaining math to people and I start explaining science to people, like, they're like, oh, yeah. And then I'm like, did you know I just taught you math? Did you know I just taught you science? And they're like, that thing that I said I'm awful at. It's like, you're not awful. You've just been telling yourself that for so long that you forget. So when I was younger, I was in like honors math, but when I was like middle school, and then I hit high school math and I was like, oh, I hate math, because that was like the nice thing to say, like, you know, the trendy thing to say. And it wasn't until I got into college that I realized, no, actually, I really love math. I actually really love math. It's just, I had some trouble with understanding a couple of concepts in one or two classes because I had a teacher who didn't know how to explain it to me. Mm-hmm. And exactly. I thought it was a horrible thing. But I really love math. I will sit here and explain math to you all day. I won't.
So can you explain the limit to me? I still don't fucking understand that.
Oh,
concept.
Sure. Okay. Do y'all really want a math lesson?
Actually, I really would. If you could explain the limit, like, I still conceptually don't get it.
You don't get what?
The limit. In calculus.
So
the concept of limit.
It's the fundamental concept of calculus in a lot of ways. So the limit is the idea that you are always approaching a specific point without ever getting there. So what is the limit of something? So you can have
that was
limit.
My joke before.
Yeah. It's that's what triggered my thought.
Okay. Yeah. No, keep going.
Wait, what? and now I just completely lost my train of thought. It's okay.
My bad. You were saying you're always approaching something and never arriving.
Yes, that is basically the limit. I actually find that a lot of people understand it better looking at a graph versus like just getting the text explanation. The worst part is, like, I had a teaching assistant for my Calc 1 class in college that actually thought that trying to teach us the formal definition of a limit, the formal mathematical one with all the mm-hmm. symbols and everything, was the way to teach us, and insisted that way. Mm. And I ended up having to retake calc because of that.
Oh, I've never passed calculus in my, I've never been able to pass calculus in my life.
Really?
And I've taken it three
times. Oh, some
times.
Of the best stuff's past calculus. Linear algebra, multivariate calculus.
I hear, but I've never been able to get past it. That's why I got out of computer science, because I couldn't do it.
All right.
I just couldn't make it happen.
I'll come up with a better one, because I know we're kind of getting close to time. I will come next week with Laura's explanation of a limit, and we'll see if I help you understand what that means.
I would adore that.
You got to understand, the only thing JJ could pass at school was wind.
Oh. You do know that's actually a lot of mathematics. Studying
fart
the wind.
Jokes?
No, studying the wind. Fluid dynamics. It's a lot of calculus.
Well, that flew over my head.
If you managed to pass that, then you actually knew more about calculus than you think.
My first U.S. patents to do with fluid dynamics, actually.
Oh, yeah.
But you did that as a child, right? You were like a child boy wonder.
Yeah, I did it in third grade.
Fucking nice. Doogie Howser over here.
and now look at me. I'm a
now he's Doogie Howser ED.
Exactly.
Oh man. All right. With that lovely equation and challenge for next week for you, Laura, thank you for signing up for that. What are people cooking this week?
I'm gonna make pasta from scratch.
Pasta.
Fun.
Yeah.
Have you done that before?
No. So while I was going to DevOps Days Houston, I had some time to watch some YouTube videos as I was decompressing. And I watched a video before going out there from Salt, Water, Fat, Acid, which is a show on Netflix. And she showed how to make pasta there. So during my trip, I watched some more videos and I realized I have everything I need to make pasta at home. So why not do it?
Salt, acid, fat, heat. I'm pretty sure. Okay, cool. Just had a.
Do you have a pasta roller?
No, but for some of the recipes I saw, I can just kind of roll it out. I mean, it shouldn't be too bad.
If you want one, swing by. I'll lend you ours.
Okay, I probably will actually take. I like using out robotics.
Yeah, instead of it is actually makes things a lot easier.
Okay.
because of the amount of rolling and laminating and stuff.
Okay.
I have to admit, when I first learned to make meringue, the chef who taught me insisted that I did it by hand so that I understood how it worked. And then I was allowed to use other things, but right. Yes, that was fun.
You just put it on high and just walk away, right?
Put your arm on high and just go forever. Yeah. Whip, whip, amazing. Whip, 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 whip. But yeah, I am, I think, I don't remember if I said it last week because we recorded twice last week and I have no idea what I actually said on the recording part. But since fall is finally here in Texas, I am making my chai concentrate again. And I will be reporting back about that next week because I know people want to know about how you make chai concentrate and all of the lovely, tasty things that that brings. It makes a great camping thing to take with you when you go camping to do on the campfire too. Well, I'm really hoping to also find a good camping spot soon that I can go to and go test out some things.
We're going to need the recipe for the show notes. Just
gonna say yes, please.
For which? Yeah. For the chai concentrate?
Yes. The answer yes, is
when
yes.
When I get it done. When
the
I get
answer
it done.
Is yes.
And then doesn't I will bring camping recipes yes. Once I get it back too. Once I get back out into the campsites now that it's cooled down.
You can make your cake in an orange thing.
I am going to make the cake in an orange. I'll be making that. I'll be making my s'morios because the s'morios are the most amazing things on the planet and lots of other things.
Right. I have a crowd cow delivery coming at some point in the next few days because someone gave me a gift voucher and there's a couple of racks of ribs in there. So I might smoke some ribs. I probably won't do the 3-2-1. I probably will not do that, but I will definitely report back. The other thing is I have a batch of sourdough potato buns proofing Ooh. Right now. So hopefully they'll be delicious. I've kind of been on and off working on the recipe for it. And I'm trying something different to what I usually do. So I'm going to see how they turn out.
That's a step back from brioche, right?
Well, so it's using potato to... like the potato starch to shorten the gluten instead of as much fat. Because brioche uses fat to shorten the gluten and potato buns kind of use the potato starch to do the same thing.
What does it mean to shorten gluten? Real quick aside, hopefully.
So, you know, shortbread cookies? You know sure. What shortbread is?
I've eaten it. That doesn't mean I know what it is.
Yeah. So basically the short is basically referred to the butter interfering with the gluten's ability to form long strands. And so there are certain things that do that. And one of those things is brioche. And that's why you kind of get that like that real fluffy texture in brioche versus the open crumb of say like a ciabatta or something else.
Okay. Very and cool.
So, yeah. Matt, what are you cooking?
You know what? I was in a little bit of a lull, but it is getting chilly. And it's reminding me of how much fun I had last fall/winter cooking up a bunch of ramen soups. So I'm rereading the ramen book, which is a free download from the gentleman who goes by Ramen Lord. It's 100 pages of intimate detail. About 50 of them are just how to make ramen noodles. Like, so it's a bunch of pasta recipes if you're into it. I kind of skipped to the tare and soup section and we got a bunch of bones I'm going to turn into some stocks. And after I do that, I'm going to start playing around with different misos. Like that I didn't like all things. There's a ton of variety and for most of my life, I thought miso was just like one block of something you bought very occasionally at the store. And now I've tried about 6 different ones. And the depending on how salty it is and how fermented it is, it's just such a massive range of flavor. So I'm going to mess with a few and try to see if I find like that right balance of the misos to make a perfect tare and then get some good stock on top of that.
Nice. Well, when I take you to Tokyo, I'll take you to my miso dealer.
Yeah.
He has like misos. Oh, of course have been, like, miso dealer. He's been misos have been aged for like 10 plus years.
Yeah, it's incredible. Honestly, they're like scotches. Yeah, they're really freaking phenomenal with age. Yeah. So that should be pretty fun. And I just love an excuse to soft boil some eggs. like one of the many reasons that you're gonna want a sous vide eventually, Laura.
Nope, I can soft boil without a sous vide.
Sous vide is really small. It's like a little like tube.
There will be no more gadgets added to my kitchen.
I'm starting to GoFundMe after this call.
No, no, we're just gonna buy one for Christmas for her. Just, you can't say no to that, right?
We'll buy one for Karmas. I don't know if you're.
Oh, there you go.
No.
Instant pots are fun. Sous vides I use more often.
Yeah, same here.
I don't want another gadget in my kitchen.
It's cool.
We are losing room. I literally turned down a s'mores maker recently.
What the hell is a s'mores maker?
Yeah.
It's a ridiculous gadget for your oven that you can make 9 s'mores because it has little cages so that you can properly cook s'mores all the way through in an oven.
Are
we still podcasting? Are we recording?
We can't. Uh-huh. We're having what you'd call a Midwestern goodbye, where we tried to hang up and we're going to talk for another 15 to 20 minutes. And then we'll say goodbye again for another 5 and then eventually get there. But when you said a s'more maker, Laura, I immediately popped to this idea of like a device you load a bunch of graham crackers into, load a bunch of chocolate, load marshmallows, and then you click a button and it makes a s'more.
Gadget like that I found on Amazon. I am disturbed when I found it, and I decided to completely block it from my memory, but thank you for reminding me that it was there. There's also one that does fondue pot. It's like a fondue pot, but it's for s'mores. So it has like a little fire in the center to roast your marshmallow, and then has like the chocolate getting melted on the outside.
Love it.
I know, it's ridiculous. I'm like, no, that is not coming to our house. Absolutely not. So
beautiful. Well,
anyway.
Well, Paul, I guess if that's enough for you, we can wrap up this call. You've been so chatty this last 10 minutes. So
yeah. Everybody say bye.
Bye.
Bye. And